The headlines: presidents of Iran and Russia meet ahead of the leaders' summit of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, highlighting expansion of Tehran-Moscow talks. Millions of Muslims are on a pilgrimage to the holy shrine of Imam Hussein, the Iraqi city of Karbala, to demonstrate their love for the grandson of Prophet Muhammad. And Hamas calls for Palestinian people to mobilize to protect the Al-Aqsa Mosque from Israeli aggression. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: the presidents of Iran and Russia were in Uzbekistan to attend the Shanghai Cooperation Organization summit, have met ahead of the event. In their meeting in the historic city of Samarkand, Ibrahim Raisi and Vladimir Putin highlighted a joint resolve to enhance their strategic ties. President Raisi said Iran and Russia can offset the effects of U.S. sanctions by joining their forces. He also criticized the Western states for proposing to hold negotiations while at the same time imposing fresh sanctions against Iran. He said they need to demonstrate a goodwill for the revival of the 2015 deal. The Russian president also noted that relations with Iran are developing positively. He said a Russian delegation of 80 business firms will visit Iran next week. Putin also threw his weight behind Iran becoming a full member of the SCO. Raisi is scheduled to meet with Chinese President Xi Jinping and Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan later in the day. Economic analyst Seyner Tangen says Chinese president's possible meeting with the Russian leader on the sidelines of the SCO summit could draw the ire of the United States.
It is expected that he will meet with Vladimir Putin, possibly Modi. The Pakistan side. So it'll be very interesting to see what comes out of it. Expect a very strong reaction from the U.S., who will be saying that any meeting with Xi with Putin is an endorsement of the situation in Ukraine. The Chinese narrative is that they're trying to build a new type of international relations. Keep in mind when you're looking at this that this is very different from the U.S.-led meetings, where, like in the Summit of Americas, where only those the U.S. wanted to be there were invited. And this particular meeting, there are countries like India and China and also Pakistan who have issues. There are also other members who have issues. And they're all meeting, and this is about dialogue, not necessarily trying to further conflict.
Iran says it remains committed to the Vienna negotiations, but will not wait for signatories to the 2015 deal to return to their obligations under the agreement. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani also says that Tehran will not wait for the United States, which unilaterally withdrew from the accord in 2018, to rejoin the deal and keep its side of the bargain. According to the spokesman, Iran acts in a dynamic, intelligent, and balanced manner to achieve the strategic objectives of its foreign policy and to enhance relations with other countries. The U.S. and the European parties to the 2015 agreement have been dragging their feet on efforts to revive the accord. Well, millions of pilgrims from across the world are converging on the Iraqi holy city of Karbala for the annual commemoration of Arba'in. The pilgrims, many of them from Iran, are making the journey toward Karbala on foot. The city houses the shrine of Imam Hussein, the grandson of Prophet Muhammad. This year, the pilgrimage, which is one of the largest religious congregations in the world, reaches its peak on the 17th of September. Arba'in marks 40 days after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein. On that day, the Imam and dozens of his companions were martyred during the Battle of Karbala nearly 14 centuries ago. Hashtag trending will look at social media reactions to the Arba'in March and the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein.
Hey everyone, welcome to another Hashtag Trending with me, Ali Reza. Millions of pilgrims from different countries have converged on the Iraqi city of Karbala to show their love and devotion to Imam Hussein. The pilgrims brave extremely hot weather to walk to the holy shrines in Karbala and Najaf. The walk is a good occasion for pilgrims to show their unfathomable love for Imam Hussein. It's also a great chance to show unity among Muslims from different countries. Social media users have taken to Twitter to show their reaction to the ongoing event. We're going to start with our first batch of tweets with this one by Sayyida Zainab. She wrote, "The biggest message of Arba'een is the universality of Islam, because Arba'een has processions and pilgrims from all over the world. Iran, Iraq, Pakistan, India, Thailand, Afghanistan, Kuwait, and so on." Tabish Abbas Patan has our next tweet. "The processions of Arba'een, which are attended by millions of people, are reflective of people's attempt to engage in self-purification, self-discipline, and the reformation of the society. In short, they are an exercise to be good soldiers for Imam Mahdi, Ajalallah. Hashtag Arba'een 2022. Ishaq Arfi said, "Arba'een's walk journey of love continues as Zawar pilgrims of Imam Hussein alayhi salam march toward the holy city of Karbala. Hashtag Arba'een 2022. Millions of Iranian pilgrims are also traveling to Iraq to take part in the Arba'een walk, and the huge number of Iranian pilgrims and the hospitality of Iraqis towards the Iranian pilgrims have provided a good chance to highlight the cultural and religious commonalities between the two countries." Let's move on to our second batch of tweets. The first one comes from Zulfaqar al-Iraqi. "Iraqi soldier carrying an elderly Iranian visitor on the Arba'een walk." Hosnia has our next tweet. She wrote, "These days, Saudi trolls are doing their best to disrupt the Arba'een walk by creating division and enmity between Iran and Iraq when saying goodbye." Our next tweet comes from Mansour Ali Khandro. He said, "An estimated over 1,000 pilgrims per hour are entering borders through Iran-Iraq. The Arba'een walk is not merely a walk. It is a rallying cry in support of the oppressed, weak, and powerless. This unique ceremony is also a chance to celebrate peace and harmony among people from different nations." Now let's move on to our final batch of tweets for the day. Our first one comes from Kazim Abbas Rezvi. He said, "Almost 20 million Shias converge on Karbala, Iraq, each year for Arba'een, many on foot from across Iraq, Iran, and abroad. According to sources, this year millions of pilgrims will go to gather in Karbala on Arba'een, making it the world's largest annual human gathering." Spring NM has our next tweet. "The Arba'een walk, the world's largest peace rally where people of all faiths coexist in harmony, love, and beauty." We have another photo shared by Samantha. She said, "Arba'een walk is the best exhibition of world peace." Moving on to our final tweet of the day, coming from Fatima T. She wrote, "Culture of Arba'een walk is the culture of the unseen world. It's not experience to see poor people of a country save for 1 year to serve pilgrims, to see people just want to give away. It's all for love of Hussein, grandson of the Prophet Muhammad." And that's a wrap for another edition of Hashtag Trending. Take care and bye-bye.
Hamas is inviting the Palestinian people to mobilize to defend the Al-Aqsa Mosque against Israeli plots. The resistance movement says the residents of Al-Quds are at the forefront of the campaign against the occupying regime, and that Palestinians are pinning their hopes on them to safeguard the holy mosque. Reports suggest that Israeli military forces and settlers are planning to launch a large-scale raid on the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the coming weeks to mark Jewish religious holidays. Radical groups are encouraging the settlers to storm the mosque at the beginning of the Jewish New Year in late September. Settlers, backed by Israeli troops, frequently raid the mosque in a move that Palestinians view as a desecration of their sanctities. Israeli deadly night raids against the city of Jenin in the occupied West Bank continue. A young Palestinian identified as Uday Salah was killed by Israeli gunfire when the military stormed his neighborhood in western Jenin overnight. He was only 15 years old. Also, another young man was wounded. The raid comes a day after two Palestinians lost their lives during an ambush against an Israeli military checkpoint near Jenin that also left an Israeli soldier dead. Israel uses routine night raids across the occupied West Bank, Jenin in particular, as a tactic to scare Palestinian residents. Dozens have been killed during these attacks this year. Facing decades of poverty and violence, Jenin has become a focal point of resistance against the Israeli occupation. We earlier talked with Mona Kandil to shed more light on the recent clashes between Israeli forces and Palestinians. Let's listen in.
They stormed the houses of two Palestinians, carried out an anti-Israel operation yesterday at the Israeli military checkpoint of Al-Jalali in Jenin. During this raid, clashes took place between Israeli forces and Palestinians, residents of the Kufr Dan village. Palestinian paramedics revealed that 15-year-old Uday Salah was seriously wounded and transferred to hospital. Then they declared that he succumbed to his injuries. We are speaking about another Palestinian was wounded during this operation. At least one Palestinian was wounded also, and he's a relative of this, of one of the Palestinian martyrs who had been killed by the Israeli soldiers yesterday. We have to mention that during the operation, or the anti-Israel operation to be specific, that was carried out yesterday at the Al-Janami military checkpoint, this had led to the killing of an Israeli soldier or an Israeli military official.
Armenia says a truce remains in place after 2 days of border clashes with Azerbaijan that left scores of servicemen dead on each side. Officials say shooting in border areas has come to a halt thanks to international peace efforts. Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan has claimed Azerbaijani forces have occupied 10 square kilometers of Armenia's territory, calling on them to leave immediately. He also put the death toll among Armenian soldiers at 105. Baku says it has lost 50 troopers in recent days. The two sides fought a bloody war over the disputed territory of Nagorno-Karabakh 2 years ago. The latest clashes, though, happened at their joint border. Baku has been planning to establish a corridor through southern Armenia to an Azerbaijani exclave bordering Turkey. But Yerevan has rejected that, saying it's against the terms of an earlier truce.
The conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia after a truce has blown up again. About 100 soldiers have died in total. This is the worst fighting between the two since the 2020 war. According to Azerbaijan's president, Ilham Aliyev, provocations committed by Armenian forces at the border have been averted and all necessary objectives were fulfilled. It blamed Armenia for the flare-up. It is widely reported that this conflict is due to the dispute over Nagorno-Karabakh region, which two wars have been fought between the former Soviet republics of Armenia and Azerbaijan. A quick history check reveals how ethnic Armenian separatists in Nagorno-Karabakh first broke away from Azerbaijan when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. The war that broke out afterwards claimed the lives of around 30,000 people. Back in 2020, when another war broke out, which lasted 6 weeks, 6,500 lives were lost. The fighting ended with a Russian-brokered ceasefire. Moscow deployed thousands of peacekeepers in the region to successfully mediate to prevent the war from continuing. The question is, what is behind the most recent flare-up?
Azerbaijan's military operations have different goals which also impact the interests of Iran, which has close ties with both Baku and Yerevan. For starters, Azerbaijan has geopolitically aligned itself with the West as well as Israel and Turkey. On the other hand, its aim is to separate Nakhchivan, its autonomous area which connects Iran to Armenia. Iran is against any such plan and has said that it would not accept any border changes between the two countries.
Azerbaijan needs access to bodies of water in order to provide energy resources to the West, which, given its relationship with Iran, Israel and Western entities would prevent that from happening. Azerbaijan's last 2 years of military action against Armenia is to cut and separate the land route between Iran and Armenia and the direct access to Nakhchivan from the southern area of Siunak or Zangezur Corridor, a concept for a transport corridor which, if implemented, would give Azerbaijan unimpeded access to Nakhchivan. Meanwhile, Israel, the U.S., Russia, and Turkey do have a hand either directly or indirectly in this conflict, all for their own political objectives. Israel is a supporter of Azerbaijan, and as such has strengthened its relationship, especially when it comes to military equipment like drones. This to have a front against Iran. Meanwhile, Iran has always had a diplomatic approach to the conflict. During the past war, it was very telling what Iran said, that renewed fighting between its neighbors, Azerbaijan and Armenia, could escalate into a wider regional war. And this is where the U.S. may have motives behind seeing a renewed conflict. One intention may be to draw Russia into this war in order to weaken its capabilities in the Ukraine conflict. And the U.S. certainly does not mind if Iran's borders are destabilized, leaving that task to its watchdog in the region, namely Israel. The U.S., however, is presenting another side to this provocation. The U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken has said that Russia may have a hand in this conflict, stirring the pot in order to distract from Russia's most recent losses in Ukraine, according to the U.S. point of view.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says Russian forces have suffered a big loss after Kiev forces rapidly advanced in the Kharkiv region.
During the first day of the Ukrainian offensive in Kharkiv region, our troops advanced 19 kilometers ahead and 110 kilometers in 5 days of combat. Almost 400 settlements were recaptured in total. 150,000 Ukrainians who remained on this territory now feel again how it is to live a normal, safe life.
Ukraine has managed to force Russia to retreat from the city of Izyum and swaths of land in the east. It has also made headway in the northeastern Kharkiv region that borders Russia. Moscow has confirmed the drawdown from Kharkiv, but says its troops are regrouping. 7 months into the war, the Kremlin insists that it will achieve its military goals. And as King Charles III takes up the reins of power as the British sovereign, questions are growing about the future of the monarchy. The king is also faced with other challenges, such as calls for independence in the remaining Commonwealth nations, where the British monarch is still the head of state. South Korea has warned North Korea against using its nuclear weapons, threatening Pyongyang with a harsh response. Peace activists have criticized the South Korean government, calling for engagement with the neighboring North. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Basing country issues on others is wrong. Pay attention to the domestic capacities. This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the president and members of the cabinet in Imam Khomeini's Husseiniyyah on August 30th, 2022. One of the most important issues that religion pursues is the creating awareness in people. It removes neglect from them. It takes away their forgetfulness and their forgetful nature. Events have taken place before our eyes. Now, some of you young people may have not witnessed these events, or you may not remember them clearly. Those important history-making events, the excitement of the people at the beginning of the revolution, the confession and astonishment of the arrogant powers in the face of this great movement that was unexpected for them. And then the start of the hostility and the different things that happened to the nations one after another. These things should be remembered. We must realize the situation we are in.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The skies of Tehran were occupied by Saddam's planes, and we had no way to confront them. The pilot would sit inside a fighter plane and pass over Tehran without having to worry about anything. And we weren't able to do anything. They would either drop bombs or break the sound barrier to ridicule the Iranian nation. That was the situation our skies were in, on the ground, in the alley, and in the streets. There were terrorism. They would go into people's homes and assassinate them. They'd assassinate soldiers, businessmen, and shopkeepers. Widespread insecurity prevailed all over the country. We're not going to forget these. These things have passed, and the Iranian nation and the system of the Islamic Republic overcame them with power and honor. Let us not forget the ups and downs. Let us not forget the blunders, the unpleasants, the ups and downs, the performance of government from the beginning of the revolution until today, the different ways that government have performed, the parliament and the likes of these.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done.
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
When it comes to Iran, Israel has never refrained from relaying its sentiment, especially when it comes to Iran's civilian nuclear program. It has always maintained that Iran is after weaponizing its nuclear program, and it has gone out of its way to provide the IAEA and the US with fabricated evidence to prove its false claim. But Israel may have stepped too far in its latest claim against Iran and the JCPOA sanctions removal talks. The head of Israel's spy agency, Mossad, said the revival of a nuclear deal with world powers will not give Iran immunity from Israeli operations. This is a fully loaded statement, which, if taken a look at closely, actually proves that Israel has executed destructive and lethal acts against Iran, including sabotaging its nuclear program, destroying Iran's nuclear facilities, and assassinating Iranian nuclear scientists, to name a few. David Bernier, in his first speech since becoming Mossad's chief, has said, "We won't take part in this charade. Even if a deal is signed, it will not provide immunity from Mossad operations." Even though Israel has never admitted to acting against Iran, this can be interpreted that the opposite is true. Iran's response to these statements were to the point. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Nasser Kanani, said, "We do not expect a terrorist regime anything other than terrorist actions." Some Israeli acts of terrorism against Iran include the assassination of four nuclear scientists and damaging Iran's nuclear facility in Karaj. Now, the question is, will the international community react to this, or will it wait until Israel commits another act of violence or terrorism against Iran?
Israel is a rogue nation. It is a terrorist nation. It will not adhere to international law. It will not respect international law. The fact that it has been working against Iran, assassinating scientists and other means against Iran, just indicates that it is a rogue nation. That if the JCPOA should be resurrected, Israel will not respect Iran's borders as it has not in the past. We have to remember that Israel has been has violated international law repeatedly, not only in Palestine, Iran, but Syria and Lebanon. Israel has no regard for international law, has no regard for human rights. So these statements by Mossad chief are just consistent with Israel's criminal activities.
Talks between Iran and the world powers on its civilian nuclear program have progressed to the point where the impasse may have been resolved towards reaching a solution. That is one of the reasons Israel has reacted by publicly stating it would not stop from executing acts against Iran. And its moves in that regard have been in overdrive. On the surface, Israeli moves to undermine the deal appears to have worked. Israel announced that it does not believe that Iran and world powers will return to their nuclear deal before the November midterm elections. And even though it looked like a deal was on the horizon, the IAEA repeated its old accusations of wanting an explanation on traces of uranium. A quarterly report by the nuclear watchdog on Iran's compliance with the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, accused Iran to have continued enrichment beyond limits in the agreement, even though Iran has demonstrated maximum transparency. But these negative reports on Iran may be political in nature. The U.S. administration and President Joe Biden may not want to jeopardize the chances for his party winning the midterm elections. Israel's Prime Minister Yair Lapid is also dealing with elections in Israel, and a deal may ruin his prospects. For now, the JCPOA survival talks has slipped back into the intensive care unit, and its chances for success appear dim.
Israel is certainly overstepping its bounds. It has no right to say that it's going to assault another nation, that it's going to ignore an agreement that, or it's going to violate an agreement that it isn't a party to, that it is trying to sabotage that agreement, which hasn't even been made yet. It is, as I mentioned before, Israel is a rogue nation, doesn't respect international law. Now, the JCPOA signed a number of years ago between European nations, the United States, and Russia, and it was the United States that violated it. The Israeli government has been opposed to it from the start and continues to be opposed to it. We have to remember, Israel is a nuclear-armed nation. It and the United States have no right to say what other countries will or will not have nuclear weapons. Now, I personally believe that the fewer nuclear weapons there are in the world, the better it is. But if Iran is being threatened by two nuclear-armed countries, it must defend itself and defend its people. But Israel, to get back to your point, is certainly overstepping its bounds. It is certainly fomenting problems within the Middle East when there don't need to be these particular problems. But this is typical of the behaviors of a terrorist nation, and that is what Israel is. It does certainly threaten its own so-called security by threatening basically war against another powerful nation. So it is doing itself no favors, but to be protected by the United States in all things, so it continues with its crimes and its threatened crimes throughout the Middle East.
Head of Hamas Political Bureau, Ismail Haniyeh, has visited the Russian capital, Moscow, to hold political talks. During his trip, he had meetings with several high-level Russian officials, including Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. The Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement has stated that Haniyeh was also accompanied by a high-ranking Hamas delegation during his Russia visit, including Deputy Hamas Chief Saleh Arouri and members of the Hamas Political Bureau. The Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement also visited Russia in May 2022, where it appealed to Moscow for support in confronting Israel. So far, Russia has been vocal about its support for Palestine, and this was indicated in Haniyeh's Moscow visit 2 years ago, where he praised Moscow for defending the rights of Palestinians, and also dismissed a pro-Israel proposal, namely former US President Donald Trump's self-proclaimed so-called deal of the century. But there has been something different about the talks held between Hamas and Russia this year. The two sides had their meetings amid simmering tensions between Moscow and Tel Aviv. Relations between Russia and Israel have taken a turn for the worse since the beginning of the Russian special military operation in Ukraine. Israel blatantly expressed its opposition to the Russian move, stating that it considers the military action a violation of international law. Moscow, on the other hand, hit back, saying Israel is trying to divert attention from the Palestine-Israel conflict.
Russia, Putin just finally got it enough with Israel's playing around. Russia has a big commitment because there's a lot of Russian Jews in Israel. But at some point, they're not getting their pensions now because of the Western sanctions. And Israel's bombing in Syria constantly, and now you've got it invading Gaza, that it's just, it's beyond the pale. And then Israel turns around and votes against Russia in the UN Human Rights Council, which is just another slap in the face, the horrors that Israel perpetuates all the time and gets away with there. So, yes, this is a moment where Russia is finally going back to its roots, which were after 48, when it played with Israel. It got burnt and it went for a moral position to support the Palestinians. And that's where Russia is returning to now. So it's an exciting moment.
Israel's hawkish stance against Russia may backfire on the regime. For starters, Russia is a UN veto-wielding member, and it can go against Israel. Furthermore, Russia's pro-Hamas stance can spread to other resistance groups, and this could translate into military support, something Israel would vehemently oppose. While Tel Aviv has been able to get away with violating Palestinian rights, now it has to worry about Hamas military action against it, and this may end up being very costly for it. Israel's remarks around the Ukraine conflict, where it slammed Russia, saying its actions are a violation of international law, have sparked anger in Moscow. And this while Russia says Israeli mercenaries are fighting side by side with the Ukrainians against the Russians only worsens the already simmering tensions. Relations between Moscow and Tel Aviv have also soured following Israel's continued airstrikes in Syria, despite criticism from Moscow. But could all this mean that Israel has given up on ties with Moscow and may even be looking for confrontation with Russia?
Israel is already confronting Russia. It was the reason behind a Russian plane being shot down, with Israel playing its tricks in the air, and this is a continual onslaught against Syria, against the Syrian government that Russia is supporting, and Russia is trying to stabilize Syria, get rid of ISIS. Israel's playing games there. It's trying to undermine Russia and Assad, and it's actually supporting ISIS at some points, along with the U.S., with its dirty tricks. So I really think that Russia, it's very much like the situation in Ukraine. Russia, Putin has been very low-key and very restrained in Ukraine. It could have blasted right from the start and killed tens of thousands and forced to surrender, but it didn't, because Ukrainians are almost Russians, and Putin didn't want that. But because of what the U.S. is doing and because of Zelensky, it's turned into a bloodbath. Well, that's exactly the same kind of situation that you see in Syria, and Israel is promoting the bloodbath. So let's hope that Russia finds against Israel, which it should have done a long time ago.
Degrading ties between Moscow and Tel Aviv have, however, sparked fresh hope for the Palestinians to become a powerful member of the international community that can upgrade its resistance against the years-long Israeli oppression, aggression, and blockades. This would also fly in the face of the U.S. side, which has staunchly supported Israel. The events of September 11, 2001 shook the world. People watched across the globe as newsreels showed a Boeing 767 crash into the North Tower of the World Trade Center just before 9 a.m. in what initially appeared to be a terrible accident. When a second plane crashed into the South Tower 18 minutes later, it became clear that this was an attack. A third plane also crashed into the Pentagon just outside Washington, D.C., and a fourth plane crashed into rural Pennsylvania. 3,000 people were immediately killed in these attacks. Al-Qaeda, which was a terrorist network led by bin Laden, was quickly identified as being responsible for the 9/11 attacks, and the Taliban housed Al-Qaeda during those times. Within 10 days of the attacks, U.S. President George W. Bush initiated America's so-called War on Terror and began its invasion of Afghanistan. In 2001, both Al-Qaeda and the Taliban were driven out of the Afghan capital in a matter of months, so the U.S. strategy soon shifted from combat to what it said was stabilizing and rebuilding the country. 10 years after the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, President Barack Obama announced that Osama bin Laden was dead, but U.S. troops stayed in the country, mostly supporting the government in Kabul through air power and training Afghan troops. While the U.S. presence seemed fruitful at first, across the rural countryside, support for the Taliban gained ground. This was mainly because of the U.S.'s massive campaign of airstrikes and bombings, much of which have had high civilian death tolls. So in essence, the Taliban had been defeated, yet the American presence brought them back from the dead. In 2021, despite America's longest war in history, the world witnessed Taliban forces sweeping through districts and gaining control of the country, and the U.S. suddenly removing its troops only facilitated the process. All this, from the U.S.'s inability to stabilize the country to its disastrous pullout, has led to questions regarding Washington's aims in Afghanistan and how it truly failed there.
Well, basically, we went into Afghanistan allegedly in response to 9/11 to find bin Laden and to kill him or to bring him to justice. We never did. And when ultimately bin Laden was found, he was not in Afghanistan. When the initial troops had been established there, there was a shift then to what might be called nation building. That is, we felt that Afghanistan should not be a home for terrorism, should not be a safe haven. Therefore, we will transform it in our own image. And this was the first sign of trouble. And we fought a war that went on for 20 years that we ultimately lost. And we withdrew with our tail between our legs as a result of a mistaken policy and a mistaken philosophy to begin with, that we could have changed other countries without knowing anything about their culture, their language, or their way of life. And that was the ultimate mistake. It led to devastation in Afghanistan.
The war on terror began more than 20 years ago by the Bush administration, with the main goal of rooting out terrorism. But the world has witnessed that it has been a complete and utter disaster, and now it is widely believed that it has led to an increase in the number of global terrorist organizations. Reports show that since the US invaded Afghanistan in 2001, terrorist organizations have almost doubled. The so-called War on Terror also gave birth to the U.S. Authorities for Use of Military Force, or the AUMF, a law that has so far drained billions of dollars out of the American people's pockets and reshaped U.S.'s foreign policy. The U.S. also used the AUMF to invade Iraq, but after years of conflict, it seems that this was all essentially a way to provide additional unilateral power to the executive branch, one which allows the U.S. to wage war and engage in conflict across the globe. While the U.S. claimed that it aimed to make the world a safer place, it has in fact done the opposite and made the world much less safe. The U.S. war on terror goes beyond the U.S. failure in Afghanistan. Terrorism has actually endured in the broader West Asia, North Africa, and South Asia regions. Today, the number of attacks and victims worldwide are 3 to 5 times higher annually than in 2001. Yet the safety of the world is now under danger by the country who set out to make the world a safer place, namely the U.S. and its continuing warmongering aspirations. The U.S. is on a war footing with nuclear-armed countries like Russia and China. It has threatened countries like Iran militarily. Thousands dead, millions displaced, and trillions of dollars wasted are all consequences of what the U.S. says is a war on terror.
The war on, so-called war on terror, was meant to keep the world safe for, you know, American control over world politics. You saw what happened in Afghanistan. I mentioned with the situation, the war in Iraq, there was a decision made. The use of U.S. military policy simply to ensure control of the United States over the world economy and over the political world is now in danger of becoming a conflict which could really end mankind. So that's the kind of thing we're facing today, and to the extent that people begin to understand that more clearly.
Iran's top general has warned of the ramifications of the growing military coordination between the U.S. Central Command, or CENTCOM, and the Israeli military, saying the Islamic Republic interprets the development as a direct threat to its national security. Chairman of the Chiefs of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Baghdadi, wrote in an online message that the terrorist U.S. military has tried to compensate for the withdrawal of its aircraft carriers, helicopter carriers, and destroyers from the Persian Gulf and the Oman Sea by connecting the child-killing Israeli military to CENTCOM.
The meaning of this action is that, from our point of view, the spying and even operational facilities of the United States and its allies will be at the disposal of the occupying Zionist regime, and this will increase the threat to our beloved country.
In his message, Baghdadi also said the regional countries that host American forces have already received written warnings from Iran, which sees the U.S. presence in the region as a serious threat.
In addition to written announcements, warnings, and conveyance of the message through the foreign ministry to countries hosting the U.S. Army, we have declared and will declare our readiness and warning through expanding our presence, including air and sea patrols, deepening our intelligence dominance, and conducting various naval, missile, and drone exercises.
The top Iranian general further said, Iran's friendly advice to neighboring countries is to uphold brotherly relations and cooperation to establish security in the region by our own countries and not by relying on foreigners. Israel moved from U.S. European Command to CENTCOM in September of last year with the aim of simplifying the cooperation with American occupation forces in the region. The move is also expected to expand military coordination between the Israeli regime and sub-Arab countries, which began to normalize their relations with the regime in Tel Aviv under U.S. brokered agreements in late 2020.
So this is really a response by the West, by the U.S., British, Canadian, Australian, Five Eyes military alliance, in an almost nervous reaction to their failed operations in the Middle East, from Afghanistan to Iraq to Libya to Syria, but they're also now seeing their failure in Ukraine, which is going to result in tremendous political uprisings that most likely will overthrow the ruling regimes in Europe. So I think Israel and the United States may very well try and open up a new military front against Syria, against Iran, using Iraq as a proxy, and this is the first step in that strategy.
Late last month, Israeli Minister for Military Affairs, Benny Gantz, made an unprecedented visit to the headquarters of the U.S. Central Command in Florida. During the visit, Gantz claimed that Israel's cooperation with CENTCOM and the countries of the region is a game-changer in confronting Iran, adding that Israel and the U.S. will continue to deepen cooperation against Iran's peaceful nuclear program, which he charged was aimed at obtaining a nuclear weapon, a baseless accusation that Tehran has time and again rejected. Washington has also been working to improve ties between Israel and its neighbors under the U.S.-brokered Abraham Accords. The deal, commonly described as normalizing relations and establishing formal diplomatic ties between the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, Sudan, and Israel. At its heart, a business deal, the Abraham Accords facilitated financial investment between the countries as well as military and surveillance cooperation. Palestinian leaders, activists, and ordinary people have repeatedly rejected Arab-Israeli normalization deals as a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian people.
The shifting political powers in Europe and the world and the Middle East are driving the Israeli reaction. Very clearly, the pendulum of political power is shifting away from the United States and Britain and Israel, and it is shifting into Asia. So you have Russia, India, Iran, China emerging as the powerhouse countries. And Israel recognizes that the Middle Eastern regimes of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, they are all shifting to seek better relations with Russia. That being said, Israel is quickly accelerating its military plans to try and bluff and seem like it is a threat. But I think at heart, it recognizes these Middle Eastern regimes names of the Wahhabi Sunni kingdoms have no political loyalty whatsoever.
Normalization is the way for the current regimes to establish their foundations and fight their peoples by transforming the battle in our region from a struggle for Palestinian and Arab rights to supporting the ambitions and plans of the occupation.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
You are a true God.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to the program, The Last Savior. I'm your host, Zainab Askari. Today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Dr. Ali Alavi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much, and thanks for inviting me to your show.
Well, Dr. Ali Alavi, we have been talking in our previous session in general about the relationship between Ashura and Mathaviyat. And then we reached a point that Ashura should be recognized by all, and this will happen until uprising by different events. Like Arbaeen is one of the very good signs, and it connotes a lot of things. It's already acting as media and a carrier of message of Ashura. And we said that one of the flag that Imam Zaman at the time of Advent will be carrying, it will be bearing a message that will be the taking the revenge of the blood of Imam Hussein Alisa. But at that time, we said that the criminals who carried out the sinners who carried out this big sin in the event of Ashura killing Imam Hussein Alisa are already dead. They are not available. So who is Imam going to take revenge from? You gave us a little explanation in previous episode. I would want you to continue with the summary of the same and continue it further.
Yes, we have been talking about the time of the advent of Imam Zaman alayhi salam and its relationship to the people who caused created the catastrophe of Ashura and killed Imam Hussein. We wanted to see how can we actually expect Imam Zaman alayhi salam to take revenge from those who are not more available. Yes, we said that in many of the hadith, that one of the signs of the reappearance of Imam Zaman is the emergence of a person called Sufyani.
Yes.
It could be a person or a movement, a country, a nation or something.
Okay.
So let's think of a person that is up by this name. He's from the sons of Utbah, the son of Abu Sufyan. So I want to ask the respected listeners to pay attention to this point, that this Sufyani is, again, from the descendant of the same, let's say,
Bani Umayyah.
Destiny of Bani Umayyah.
All right.
So this is one relation, but a person who is from destiny of a group or lineage, so why should he be, let's say, punished for what he did not do?
Exactly.
So this is actually like a usurpation. Look, suppose that, for example, there is a piece of land and one of your ancestors, grandfathers, actually usurped it from a person.
Yeah.
And you inherited that land and you know, you got to know, okay, it was usurped by your, let's say, grandfather.
Yeah.
In case you continue to usurp that land, you are like your grandfather.
Again, yeah.
See? So in case you give it back to the owners, to the real owners of that land, you have done the right thing.
Yeah.
So a person like him, like Sufyani, in case he knows that actually what happened and what he did and what his ancestors did, again, in case he actually purposely continues the same way, so he's again, the revenge should be done on him.
Yeah.
Moreover, let me give you one more aspect of this Sufyani and the issues around him. Bani Umayyad destiny that we know at the, let's say, history of Islam, at the dawn of Islam, these destiny were actually a mixture of those who actually accepted Islam and those who were among the Jews. And they, at least the relationship between Bani Umayyad and the Jews at the dawn of Islam was too much.
Okay.
You see, this is one aspect. Put it in your, a part of your mind, inshallah.
Yeah.
And the second, again, we have in a hadith that he is from one side, he is from the sons of Utbah, that
all
is
right.
from the descendants of, let's say, Abu Sufyan.
Okay.
And from other side, we say that he comes from Rome.
Okay.
Like, that is the best. So I want to make, let's say, simile between, or I want to make a relationship between all these hadith and to make one
conclusion
general understanding.
Out of it.
A conclusion.
Let's make it a little curious for the audiences. We'll answer that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio. Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is The Last Savior. I'm with Dr. Ali Alavi, and we are talking about the relationship between Ashura and Mehthaviyat. And right now we're discussing the point that who are the ones that Imam Zaman, Ajallaha Ta'ala Faraja, is going to take revenge from, the revenge of Ashura, actually. You said a lot of narrations, and now you're trying to deduce one conclusion out of
it. So this Sufyani is from the descendant of Bani Umayyah, one side in Hadith, and he, from the other side, we read that it comes from Rome. Some actually have mixed between whatever is being said about Sufyan or Dajjal.
Yeah.
No, before the reappearance of Imam, we didn't have any concept of Dajjal. So it is a mistranslation that has been done by some Christian sources. So whatever we are expecting before the advent of Imam is Sufyani. So from one side, they say that they are coming from West or Rome, the Rome of the past, which equals the West of today.
Yeah.
And some from the descendant of Abu Sufyan.
Okay.
Look at the day that we are in. There are some people who have a good relation with each other. Some who are really from the descendant of Abu Sufyan and the Jews. They have mixed a sort of front called Arabi-Ibri.
Yeah.
Ibri-Arabi.
Yeah.
Or can we say that, okay, even this Sufyani is very close to the word Sahyani or Sahyun. Does it actually stick anything to our minds that this person can be connected to that? Or this movement or this country is the same that they have come from West and they have now joined with the descendant of Abu Sufyan.
And they have all those characteristics.
And they have all those characteristics. And they did lots of problems in the region. In the same region, the Wadi Yabes. So exactly, where is Wadi Yabes? Close to Sham, that is the place that now the Israel is located.
Yeah.
So among the signs of the reappearance of Imam is the Sufyani. We are not going to determine any time or any place for the reappearance of Imam because it is against the narrations. But I want to say that, okay, it could at least bring a sort of, let's say, hints to our minds that this Sufyani and Sahyani could be very close to each other. So maybe during, in the course of writing these histories, something actually changed and the words actually changed there.
Like we have
translation or transliteration.
So we have a lot of things like that. We'll talk more on that, Dr. Alavi, after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shadow.